Well, Colin Powell passed on earlier this week. We discuss the man, his track record, his legacy with Scott Lucas, founder and editor of EA Worldview. He's also a professor at the University of Birmingham in the UK, and Abdul Baset, a research fellow at the RSIS in Singapore. Scott, a very good morning to you. Welcome to Radio Islam International once again.
Very good morning. Thank you for having me here.
Abdul Baset, assalamu alaikum. Welcome.
Wa alaikum salam. Thank you for having me on your show.
All right, Scott, for those whose knowledge is less than basic, who was Colin Powell?
Colin Powell was a high-profile official in the U.S. government, both the military and political side, for almost 40 years. His career, military career, started in Vietnam. He rose quickly through the military ranks. And by the Reagan administration of the 1980s, he had become the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the highest military position in the United States. He then became the first African-American to become National Security Advisor. And in the administration of the younger George Bush, he became the first African-American to become Secretary of State. But probably what your listeners will remember beyond any other event in that very, full 40-year career in military and public service is that appearance in February 2003 before the UN General Assembly, where he propped up the Bush administration's lie that Iraq's Saddam Hussein had chemical and biological weapons, a lie that was pursued in order for the United States to lead the invasion of Iraq and remove Saddam Hussein from power.
That lie is a big factor, Scott, when determining his legacy. To what extent did he have control? Was he just forced because he was the Secretary of the State at the time and decisions were made by the President and others, and he just was unlucky to be the person who had to do it? Or was he self-motivated to a significant extent?
You know, I'm wrestling with this because Colin Powell is a very intelligent man, very capable man. He knew that at best the claim of Saddam having chemical and biological weapons was not supported, that it had not been established. And he probably knew, in fact, that other officials in the Bush administration, high-ranking officials, were pushing this falsehood, that there was no reason to believe those weapons still existed. But at the end of the day, I think that Colin Powell was a loyal soldier. He was a loyal soldier when he was in the military. He, of course, held one of the highest ranks in the U.S. government during the first Iraq War in 1991. He was loyal during the Reagan administration when the U.S. government was involved in activities from Central America to Afghanistan to the Middle East. And he decided as a loyal soldier on that fateful day in February 2003 that even though he knew that this was a deception or probably a deception, he would not resign. And he would carry out his duty. I think he regretted it later in life. But at the end of the day, I think Colin Powell, I think he's a powerful symbol because he represents not only the two sides of his career, for many, this man of achievement who had risen from poverty, who despite his race had held the highest ranks in the U.S. government. But for his critics, he represented the ability to sort of carry out a deadly lie. And in a way, that's sort of the dual side of American foreign policy, that it could do good. It could try to uphold values. It could, for example, pursue the rebuilding of Europe after World War II. But on the other hand, that U.S. foreign policy, in the name of those values, could betray them and indeed could lead to the deaths of many, many hundreds of thousands of people.
Abdul Baset, how is Colin Powell viewed in the U.S.?
I think your guest, the earlier participant, has articulated the views quite clearly. I think it's a mixed legacy. Part of his life is, full of achievements as outlined, but the later half, his political career, particularly the role in the invasion of Iraq, is, I think, what is the decisive factor in deciding the political legacy and the consequences of that legacy, the way American image as a power in the world has taken a hit. Currently, what we see in the world, the power is declining. In that equation, the decision that the Bush administration took at that time, going to invade Iraq, and the mentality which continued, series of events in the Middle East, for instance, continuous obsession of, you know, of intervening maybe in Iran. They went to Libya, they went to Syria, there were others as well, of course. And then the current in developments in Afghanistan, where America had to withdraw, and in the congressional hearing, they conceded defeat. So I think these events are related to the decisions which were taken at that time. Had America not invaded Iraq on a false pretext, as the participant rightly pointed out, maybe things could have been different. So I think that's the legacy. And when American history will be wrote, I think those decisions, the way the history is going to unfold in the coming years, it would be traced back to those fateful decisions. So I think that's the legacy, and that's how the entire administration and office holders of the Bush administration would be remembered.
To your knowledge, Abdul Basit, did Powell ever apologize? It's mentioned that he later regretted it, but did he ever apologize?
Not to the best of my knowledge. I haven't seen any public apology. Had it been there, it would have been, it would have created a big buzz. I mean, he is the person who went to the UN and he, you know, actually made a case for the invasion that there are WMDs which were not there. And then later on, the officials of the Bush administration were saying it wasn't about WMDs, it wasn't about Saddam. They would have, you know, intervened or invaded Iraq anyways. So it represented that new con mentality in a way. So I think even if he regretted it, it takes a statesman to, you know, publicly apologize, but he didn't. So I think that's the kind of legacy he died with. And that is how I think he is going to be remembered. So I think the decision he took in his political career would overshadow the earlier part of his life, where he rose from, you know, very humble backgrounds to become a general in the U.S. military. Then he was Secretary of State and was involved in very fateful decisions that I think in the coming years is going to are going to decide America's status as the superpower, which is in the decline currently.
Scott, you spoke briefly about his career prior to politics and prior to becoming Secretary of State. Was he of a similar approach? Was he in favor of war and military confrontation in his military days prior to getting involved in politics?
No, Colin Powell actually was striking the fact that he thought military confrontation, even as he was the head of the U.S. military, as Chairman, Joint Chiefs of Staff, was not always the preferred option. Indeed, shouldn't even be the last resort option. He's the man who actually gave his name to a doctrine, the Powell Doctrine, which stated very simply and bluntly is you break it, you buy it. So that if you pursue military action, you own the consequences of the action. You own the consequences of any devastation or of any damage to your reputation or of any discord that could continue long after it happens. But that said, again, he was a loyal soldier. So when the Reagan administration pursued the illegal and covert operations in Central America, including the attempt to overthrow the government in Nicaragua, again, an attempt which caused the deaths of many, many people, Powell didn't stand aside from it. When the United States, during the Reagan administration, was involved in some of the disastrous operations in the Middle East, not only over Israel and Palestine, but over Lebanon, for example, Colin Powell didn't stand aside from that. And, of course, Colin Powell didn't stand aside from what was largely a covert operation, but it was one that, you know, the Reagan officials supported, which was to arm the fighters in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union, which, you know, in the eyes of of those who fought communism was valid, but in the eyes of those who later look at Afghanistan said it led to further decades of discord. So no, you know, at the end of the day, even up to 2003, you get this irony that the man who said, you break it, you buy it. If you pursue military action in a place like Iraq, you'll own the consequences. He's the man who gives the speech that justifies the invasion that breaks Iraq. It breaks Iraq, however, not really for America. It breaks it for those hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who die, who are wounded, who are displaced from their homes, all the way up to the rise of the Islamic State and the further violence and man-made tragedy from 2014 onward.
What did Colin Powell do, Scott, after he left political office, after he served his one term as Secretary of State? We know in the last few years he was publicly critical of Donald Trump. Many found that ironic because they feel that as much as Trump was the clown in the White House, his foreign policy did not cause as much destruction as that of the Bush administration within which Colin Powell had served.
Colin Powell, who some had touted as being perhaps the first African American to become president before, you know, even before Barack Obama achieved that, instead he retreated from politics. I think he was badly bruised by the fact that he had been a military man, that he had moved into the political arena, and here was this legacy that Abdul Basit talked about, this you know, devastation in Iraq. He would come out and make statements at certain points. He finally made the statement, not until 2010, which said, you know, it effectively was wrong what he had done at the UN, even though he didn't apologize to the Iraqi people. But he was very limited in making statements, the most famous being, however, that he would not. He went before the Democratic National Convention in 2016 and said he would not support Donald Trump. What we're left with, however, I think are two interesting things. That for Americans, he has sort of been redeemed because Trump was so bad. Even if Trump wasn't as deadly, the fact is that George W. Bush is able to appear in public and be hailed as a much better president than Trump. Powell has been redeemed. The death of Donald Rumsfeld passed almost without comment. But the other legacy of Powell is an interesting one, that we drew the wrong lessons from Iraq, and that by drawing the wrong lessons from Iraq, the irony is not only America, but the international community have failed to protect civilians in places like Libya, in places like Syria, in places like Yemen. In other words, that one tragedy of Iraq in 2003 that was unnecessary. We have an ongoing tragedy throughout the Middle East. That what do we do about governments who do repress their civilians, who do kill hundreds of thousands of them? Do America and the international community just stand aside?
Abdul Basit, Iraq is central then to the legacy of Colin Powell. How would you assess the situation in Iraq today, almost 20 years later? Are Iraqis in the main better off now than they were under the oppressive rule of Saddam Hussein?
I mean, absolutely not. Current situation in Iraq is far from normal, far from satisfactory. It's a divided society. The state is broken. It is vulnerable to external interference from Iran, interference from the U.S., other neighboring countries. There are sectarian schisms. I'm not saying these things were not there at the time of Saddam Hussein. The dictatorial rule of Saddam Hussein had its own problems. It has its own issues. We can't compare the two, but what America has done, and Colin Powell, as you said, is central to that decision, to that country, is regrettable. It look at the society now. Iraq was one of the most powerful military country in the Middle East. It is nowhere near that currently. You know, those divisions within the society only continue to get worse by the day. And it all relates to the invasion of Iraq. The Islamic State of Iraq, or Daesh, as it is known in the Middle East, was not there. It became, you know, a thing starting 2005, 2006, with Al-Qaeda actually, Osama al-Zarqawi going from Afghanistan to Iraq, and then the history goes on, and in 2014 it becomes Daesh, the most feared transnational terrorist group in the world. It has its roots in Iraq. It is still there. The group is not as potent as it was, but it is still it is far from defeated or eliminated. All of it is part of that legacy. So and it's not just about Iraq. Iraq is just one part of the story. From the invasion of Iraq, what started in the Middle East, what happened in Libya, what happened in Syria, and part is related to that. So the chaos in the broader Middle East, America has a lion's share of blame to take alongside these regional powers, Saudi Arabia and Iran. So I think that is what defines the legacy, and that is how it will, unfortunately, will be remembered.
Abdul Basit and Scott, we thank you both for your time this morning. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. That was Scott Lucas from the UK and Abdul Basit from Singapore talking to us about the legacy of Colin Powell, the former Secretary of State for the United States. He passed on a couple of days ago. He was central to the invasion of Iraq. He went to the United Nations and claimed that there were weapons of mass destruction. Remember those days, almost 20 years later. Right, it's 8:31 in the AM. Time now for the Elections Desk. Ibrahim Deen, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thanks for having me.
So there are mounting legal battles for the IEC as the elections loom.
Yes, I mean, the BLF is now, Black First, Land First Party has now taken the institute, in a sense, to court for not registering its candidates. Apparently, at the time of registration, the IEC website was down, and the BLF tried to use a different method, and the IEC denied it. Now, the bigger issue here is that, there does seem to be a lot of looming ones. There's the BLF battle, there's the one with the Action SA. The IEC lost a court case in the Constitutional Court trying to postpone the local government election. So, it does seem as if there's some systemic flaws in the organization, and this then, sometimes raises doubts about the perceived neutrality of the organization. I mean, at the moment, there doesn't seem to be any real evidence behind, this perceived, lack of neutrality. But, in any election, trust is a very important thing. And as the institution that organizes the election starts to lose trust, then many may start becoming, a bit more disillusioned with the election process itself.
Now, the ANC, the EFF runs the slogan Land and Jobs Manje. You did some fact-checking promises with regards to the EFF's 2021 election manifesto?
Yes, I mean, it was a very good report published by Africa Check. So it talks about, for example, the EFF talks about, abolishing tenders. That's not possible because there's no local government capacity to actually deal with tenders. And in actual fact, to deal with, insourcing. And also tenders were generally supposed to actually lead to cheaper services, not more expensive services. Then, the issue of expropriation without compensation. There's already a constitutional committee looking at the issue, but, even if it allows for expropriation without compensation, there will have to be the Minister of Public Works involved in the process, so it can't be done at the local government level. There's the issue of, indigents being, that the manifesto talks about indigents being given free services based on, if they accept or receive a social grant. Now, the big issue with this is that one is, these services are partially compensated by national and provincial government. And so, they need some tracking mechanism to allow for this compensation. So it's not, again, feasible, in that light. And lastly is the issue of just general bureaucracy that, the EFF is talking about, insourcing bureaucracy, which is not necessarily possible in South Africa's current system. So it's more issues that deal with policy rather than actual implementation. And that means it's more promises, not actually things that can be done, if they were to govern.
And then Ramaphosa is urging the ANC candidates to fix finances and service delivery.
I mean, I think, Ramaphosa introduced them at a meeting, which is quite well coordinated in Alberton yesterday, all 10,000 ANC candidates. the normal pledges for better service delivery, better service provision, and Ramaphosa's statement that communities were consulted. The bigger issue, though, is if we're looking at all these ANC launches and all these ANC manifestos, all of them are basically saying we got it wrong. Please give us another chance, and that's the theme we're seeing through all. We have made mistakes in the past, and the question is whether South Africans would actually believe this or trust this. And generally South Africans are quite amenable to apologies, but the problem is once it becomes too much or too many apologies and no real change, then mindset may begin to change.
Yeah, Ibrahim, shukran so much for your time. We'll talk again next week, not next week, tomorrow, inshallah.
Okay,
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.